You're listening to KBOO, Portland. Union of Time Thieves coming right up.
Becky, and I'm your host for today's program. I'm a member of the Union of Time Thieves, which was created to reclaim the world we all live in from the powers of alienation. Using the writings and tools developed by the Situationist International, we hope to break free of the spectacle and to inspire others to join our cause, the revolutionary jamming of culture. Every show focuses on a theme. This month, the Union of Time Thieves presents to you the work entitled E fericorti con l'assistente I suoi difensori e I suoi falsi critici, as an example of a modern work that incorporates materials formulated by the Situationist International. I Feri Corti is an Italian piece, first published in 1998 anonymously, and was translated into English as At Daggers Drawn. This work has been published and distributed many times over, and is an argument for how to combat the spectacle, which, as you may recall, is a social relation among people mediated by images. To go further, the spectacle is the heart of unrealism of the real society. In all its specific forms as information or propaganda, as advertisement or direct entertainment consumption, the spectacle is the present model of socially dominant life. This work discusses why and how we should actively dismantle spectacular society now. We Time Thieves would like to note that this show is a direct reading from the text and that some of the terminology may have other cultural implications outside of what we understand them to be. Also, know that this is an academic and artistic exploration of I Feri Corti. We welcome further discussion on the themes of the show on our Facebook page. Look up the Union of Time Thieves. Let's begin. Than a continual search for something to cling to. One gets up in the morning to find oneself in bed a mere matter of hours later, a sad communer between lack of desire and fatigue. Time passes, spurring us less and less. Social obligations no longer seem to break our backs, as we have got used to spreading the weight. We obey without even taking the trouble to say yes. Death is expiated by living, wrote the poet from another trench. We can live without passion or dreams. That is the great liberty the society offers us. We can talk endlessly, particularly of things we know nothing about. We can express any opinion we like, even the most daring, and disappear behind the murmuring. We can vote for the candidate we prefer, demanding the right to complain in exchange. We can change channels at any time should we seem to be getting dogmatic. We can enjoy ourselves at specific moments, traversing sadly identical environments at increasing speed. We can appear to be young hotheads before receiving icy bucketfuls of common sense. We can get wed as often as we like, so sacred is marriage. We can employ ourselves usefully and, if we can't write, become journalists. We can do politics in a thousand ways, even talking about exotic gorillas. In careers as in love, if we don't quite make it to giving orders, we can always excel in obeying. Obedience can make martyrs of us all. And in spite of appearances, this society needs heroes. Our stupidity certainly won't seem any worse than anyone else's. It doesn't matter if we can't make up our minds. We can let others decide for us. Then we will take a stand, as they say in the jargon of politics and the spectacle. There is never any lack of justification, especially in the world of those who aren't fussy. In this great fairground of roles, we all have one loyal ally. Money. Democratic par excellence. It respects no one in particular. In its presence, no commodity or service can be denied us. It has the whole of society behind it, no matter who it belongs to. Of course, this ally never gives enough of itself and, moreover, does not give itself to all. But the hierarchy of money is a special one, uniting what the conditions of life set against each other. When you have it, you are always right, and when you don't, you have plenty of extenuating circumstances. With a bit of practice, we could get through a whole day without one single idea. Daily routine thinks in place of us. From work to free time, everything comes about within the continuity of survival. We always have something to cling to. The most stupefying characteristic of today's society is the ability for comfort to exist a hair's breadth from catastrophe. The economy and the technological administration of the existent are advancing with irresponsible recklessness. One slips from entertainment to large-scale massacre with the disciplined insensitivity of programmed gestures. Death's buying and selling extends over the whole of time and space. Risk and brave effort no longer exist. There remains only security or disaster, routine or catastrophe, saved or submerged, alive, never. With a bit of practice, we could walk from home to school, the office to the supermarket, or the bank to the disco, eyes closed. Now we can understand the adage of the old Greek sage, quote, "The dormant also maintain the world order." The time has come to break away from this we, a reflex of the only community that now exists, that of authority and commodities. One part of the society has every interest in its continuing to rule, the other in everything collapsing as soon as possible. Deciding which side one is on is the first step. But resignation, the basis of the agreement between the sides, improvers of the existent and its false critics, is everywhere, even in our own lives. The authentic place of the social war, and in our desires and resoluteness as well as in our little daily submissions. It is necessary to come to daggers with all of that, to finally come to daggers with life. The secret is to really begin. The present social organization is not just delaying, it is also preventing and corrupting any practice of freedom. The only way to learn what freedom is to experiment it, and to do so, you must have the necessary time and space. The fundamental premise for free action is dialogue. Now, any authentic discourse requires two conditions: a real interest in the questions brought up to be discussed, the problem of content, and the free search for possible answers, the problem of method. These two conditions should occur at the same time, given that the content determines the method and vice versa. One can only talk of freedom in freedom. What is the point of asking questions if we're not free to answer? What is the point of answering if the questions are always false? Dialogue only exists when individuals can talk to each other without mediation, i.e., when they relate reciprocally. If the discourse is one way, no communication is possible. If someone has the power to impose the questions, the content of the latter will be directly functional to this, and the answers will contain subjection. Subjects can only be asked questions whose answers confirm their role as such, and from which the bosses will draw the questions of the future. The slavery lies in continuing to reply. In this sense, market research is identical to the elections. The sovereignty of the elector corresponds to the sovereignty of the consumer, and vice versa. TV passivity is called audience. The legitimization of the power of the state is called sovereign people. In either case, individuals are simply hostages in a mechanism that gives them the right to speak after having deprived them of the faculty to do so. What is communication if all your only choice is between identical goods and TV programs? The content of the question is meaningless because the method is false. Quote, "Nothing resembles a representative of the bourgeoisie more than a representative of the proletariat," Sorel wrote in 1907. What made them identical was the fact that they were precisely representatives. To say the same of the left or right-wing candidate today would be banal, but politicians do not need to be original. Advertising takes care of that. It is sufficient for them to know how to administer that banality. The irony is that the media are defined a means of communication, and the voting space is called elections, which, in the true sense of the word, means free, conscientious decision. The point is that power does not allow for any other kind of management. Even if the voters wanted it, which would already take us into full utopia, to imitate the language of the realists, nothing important could be asked of them from the moment that the only free act, the only authentic election they could accomplish, would be not to vote. Anyone who votes wants inconsequential questions, as authentic questions deny passivity and delegation. But we'll explain better. Imagine that the abolition of capitalism were to be requested through referendum. Putting aside the fact that such a question is impossible in the context of existing social relations, most of the electorate would vote in favor of capitalism simply because, as they tranquilly leave home, the office, or the supermarket, they cannot imagine a world other than one with commodities and money. But even if they were to vote against it, nothing would change, as, to be authentic, such a question would exclude the existence of voters. A whole society cannot be changed by decree. The same could be said for less radical questions. Take the example of the housing estate. What would happen if the inhabitants were able, once again, we would be in utopia, to express themselves concerning the organization of their own lives? Housing, streets, squares, etc. Let us say right away that such demands would inevitably be limited from the start, because housing estates are a consequence of the displacement and concentration of the population according to the needs of the economy and social control. Nevertheless, we could try to imagine some form of social organization other than such ghettos. One could safely say that most of the population would have the same idea as the police on the subject. Otherwise, that is, if even limited practice of the dialogue were to give rise to the desire for a new environment, this would mean the explosion of the ghetto. How, under the present social order, do you reconcile the inhabitants' desire to breathe with the interests of the bosses of the motor industry? Free circulation of individuals with the fears of the luxury boutique owners? Children's play areas with the cement of car parks, banks, and shopping ventures? The empty houses left in the hands of the speculators? The blocks of flats that look like army barracks, that look like schools, that look like hospitals, that look like asylums? To move one wall in this labyrinth of horrors would mean putting the whole scheme in question. The further we move away from a police-like view of the environment, the closer we get to clashing with the police. How can you think freely in the shadow of a church, wrote an anonymous hand on the sacred wall of the Sorbonne during May 1968. This impeccable question has wider implications. Anything that has been designed for economic or religious purposes cannot fail to impose anything but economic or religious desires. A desecrated church continues to be the house of God. Commodities continue their chatter in an abandoned shopping center. The parade ground of a disused barracks still contains the marching of the soldiers. That is what he who said that the destruction of the Bastille was an act of applied social psychology meant. The Bastille could never have been managed as anything other than a prison, because its walls would have continued to tell the tale of incarcerated bodies and desires. Subservience, obligation, and boredom espouse consumerism in endless funereal nuptials. Work reproduces the social environment, which reproduces the resignation to work. One enjoys evenings in front of the TV because one has spent the day in the office and in the underground. Keeping quiet in the factory makes shouting in the stadia a promise of happiness. Feelings of inadequacy at school vindicate the insensate irresponsibility of a Saturday night at a disco. Only eyes emerging from a McDonald's are capable of lighting up when they see a Club Med billboard, etc. You need to know how to experience freedom in order to be free. You need to be free yourself in order to experience freedom. Within the present social order, time and space prevent experimentation of freedom because they suffocate the freedom to experiment. The necessity of insurrection. Not in the sense of inevitability, an event that must take place sooner or later, but in the sense of a concrete condition of possibility. The necessity of the possible. Money is necessary in the society, yet a life without money is possible. To experience this possibility, it is necessary to destroy the society. Today, one only experiences what is societally necessary. Curiously, those who consider insurrection to be a tragic error or an unrealistic romantic dream talk a lot about social action and areas of freedom for experimentation. One only has to squeeze such arguments a little, however, for all of the juice to come out of them. As we said, in order to act freely, it is necessary to be able to talk to each other without mediation. And about what, how much, and where can one engage in dialogue at the present time? In order to discuss freely, one must snatch time and space from social obligations. After all, dialogue is inseparable from struggle. It is inseparable materially. In order to talk to each other, it is necessary for us to take time and seize the necessary space. And psychologically, individuals like talking about what they do because that is how words transform reality. We forget we are all living in a ghetto, even if we don't pay rent and every day is a Sunday. If we are not capable of destroying this ghetto, the freedom to experiment will be a poor thing indeed. Many libertarians believe that social change can and must come about gradually without any sudden rupture. For this reason, they talk of areas free of the state in which to elaborate new ideas and practices. Leaving aside the decidedly comical aspects of the question, where does the state not exist? How do you put it in parentheses? You can see the point of reference for such questions remains the self-managed federalist methods experimented by subversives at particular times in history, such as the Paris Commune, Revolutionary Spain, the Budapest Commune, etc. What one omits to say, however, is that the possibility of talking to one another and changing reality was taken by the rebels with arms. In short, a small detail is left out. Insurrection. You cannot remove a method. Neighborhood meetings, direct decision-making, horizontal linking up, etc. from the context that made it possible, or even draw it up against the latter. For example, there is no point in attacking the state. We must self-organize, make utopia concrete. Before thinking about what the proletarian councils signified, for example, and what they could signify today, it is necessary to consider the conditions under which they existed. 1905 in Russia, 1918 through 1921 in Germany and Italy, etc. These were insurrectional times. Will someone please explain how it would be possible for the exploited to decide in first person on questions of any importance today without breaking social normality by force? Only then will you be able to talk about self-management or federalism before discussing what self-managing the present productive structures, quote, after the revolution means. It is necessary to be aware of one simple thing. Neither the bosses or the police would agree to it. You cannot discuss a possibility while omitting the conditions required to make it concrete. Any idea of freedom implies breaking with the present society. Let us see one last example. Direct democracy is also talked about in libertarian circles. One could retort that the anarchist utopia opposes itself to the method of majority decision. Right. But the point is that no one talks about direct democracy in real terms. Leaving aside those who pass it off as quite the opposite, i.e., the constitution of civic lists and participation in the municipal elections, let us consider those who imagine real citizens' assemblies where people talk to each other without mediation. What would the so-called citizens be able to express? How could they reply differently without changing the questions? How make a distinction between so-called political freedom and the present economic, social, and technological conditions? No matter how you twist things, you cannot escape the problem of destruction unless you think that a technologically centralized society could at the same time become federalist, or that generalized self-management could exist in the true prisons that the cities of the present day have become. To say that all the changes that are necessary could be done gradually merely confuses the issue. Change cannot even begin to take place without widespread revolt. Insurrection is the whole of social relations opening up to the adventure of freedom once the mask of capitalist specialization has been torn off. Insurrection does not come up with the answers on its own. That is true. It only starts asking questions. So the point is not whether to act gradually or adventuristically. The point is whether to act or merely dream of acting. The critique of direct democracy, to stick with the same example, must be concrete. Only then is it possible to go beyond and think that the social foundations of individual autonomy really exist. only then is it possible for this going beyond to become a method of struggle here and now. Subversives need to criticize other people's ideas and need to define them more precisely than those who swear by them. The better to sharpen their daggers. It is out of fashion to believe that social transformation is still possible. The masses, it is said, are in a deep trance and fully integrated within the social norms. At least two conclusions can be drawn from such a remark: that rebellion is impossible, or that it is only possible in small numbers. This either becomes an openly institutional discourse about the need for elections, legal conquests, etc., or one in favor of social reform, union self-organization, struggle for collective rights, etc. The second conclusion can become the basis of the classical vanguardist discourse, or of an anti-authoritarian one in favor of permanent agitation. Here it can be said that throughout history, ideas that were apparently in opposition to each other actually share the same roots. Take social democracy and Bolshevism, for example. They clearly both came from the supposition that the masses do not have any revolutionary consciousness, so need to be led. Social democrats and Bolsheviks only differed in the methods used. Reformist party or revolutionary party, parliamentary strategy or violent conquest of power, in the identical program of bringing consciousness to the exploited from the outside. Let us take the hypothesis of a minoritarian subversive practice that refuses the Leninist model. In a libertarian perspective, one either abandons all insurrectional discourse in favor of a declaredly solitary revolt, or sooner or later it becomes necessary to face the problem of the social implications of one's ideas and practices. If we don't want to resolve the question in the ambit of linguistic miracles, for example, by saying that the theses we support are already in the heads of the exploited, or that one's rebellion is already part of a wider condition, one fact remains: we are isolated, which is not the same as saying we are few. Not only does acting in small numbers not constitute a limit, it represents a totally different way of seeing social transformation. Libertarians are the only people to envisage a dimension of collective life that is not subordinated to central direction. Authentic federalism makes agreements between free unions of individuals possible. Relations of affinity do not exist on the basis of an ideology or quantity, but start off from reciprocal knowledge, from feeling and sharing projectual passions. But projectual affinity and autonomous individual action are dead letters. If they cannot spread without being sacrificed in the name of some claimed higher necessity, it is the horizontal link that concretizes the practice of liberation, an informal link of fact without representation. A centralized society cannot exist without police control and a deadly technological apparatus. For this reason, anyone who is incapable of imagining a community without state authority is devoid of instruments with which to criticize the economy that is destroying the planet. Anyone who is incapable of imagining a community of unique individuals has nothing to put in the place of political mediation. On the contrary, the idea of free experimentation in a coming together of like-minded people with affinity as the basis for new relations makes complete social upheaval possible. only by abandoning the idea of center, the conquest of the Winter Palace, or to bring things up to date, state television, does it become possible to build a life without imposition or money. In such a direction, the method of spreading attacks is from the struggle that carries a different world within it. To act when everyone advises waiting. When it is not possible to count on great followings. When you do not know beforehand whether you will get results or not. Means one is already affirming what one is fighting for. A society without measure. This, then, is how action in small groups of people with affinity contains the most important of qualities. It is not mere tactical contrivance, but already contains the realization of one's goal. Liquidating the lie of the transitional period, such as dictatorship before communism, power before freedom, wages before taking the lot, certainty of the results before taking action, requests for financing before expropriation, ethical banks before anarchy, etc., means making the revolt itself a different way of conceiving relations. Attacking the technological hydra right away means imagining a life without white-coated policemen, or without the economic or scientific organization that makes them necessary. Attacking the instruments of domestication by the media now means creating relations that are free from images, or free from the passivity that fabricates them. Anyone who starts screaming that it is no longer, or not yet, time for rebellion is revealing the kind of society they want in advance. On the other hand, to stress the need for social insurrection now, and uncomfortable movement that breaks with historical time to allow the emergence of possible, means simply, we want no leaders. Today, the only federalism is a generalized rebellion. If we refuse centralization, we must go beyond the quantitative idea of rallying the exploited for a frontal clash with power. It is necessary to think of another concept of strength. Burn the census lists and change reality.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Storefront Review, produced by the Triangle Theater from May 7th through the 30th at the Sanctuary at 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. Storefront was a thriving theater company in Portland, which closed in 1991. Triangle Theater is bringing back some of the burlesque acts and performances from this bygone era. Again, that's the Storefront Review, produced by the Triangle Theater from May 7th through the 30th at the Sanctuary at 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Improvisation Summit of Portland, June 4th through 6th at Disjecta in Portland. This all-ages event brings together musicians, dancers, and experimental performers for 3 days of improvisational art. Performers include Roscoe Mitchell, Jonah Parzan Johnson, Linda Austin, Gordon Ashworth, Either Neither, and many, many more. Again, that's the Improvisation Summit of Portland, Thursday, June 4th through June 6th at Disjecta, 8371 North Interstate Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'm Dr. Demento. This is KBOO Portland, and you are now in the control of the Union of Time Thieves.
Think of another concept of strength. Perhaps this is the new poetry. Basically, what is social revolt if not a generalized game of illegal matching and divorcing of things? Revolutionary strength is not a strength that is equal to and against that of power. Everything would be reduced to military conflict, a danse macabre of standards. Real movements escape the quantitative glance. The state and capital possess the most sophisticated systems of control and repression. How can we oppose this Moloch? The secret lies in the art of breaking apart and putting together again. The movement of intelligence is a continual game of breaking up and establishing correspondences. The same goes for subversive practice. Criticizing technology, for example, means considering its general framework, seeing it not simply as an assemblage of machinery, but as a social relation, a system. It means understanding that a technological instrument reflects the society that produces it, and that its introduction changes relations between individuals. Criticizing technology means refusing to subordinate human activity to profit. Otherwise, we would be deceiving ourselves as to the implications of technology, its claims to neutrality, the reversibility of its consequences. It then becomes necessary to break it up into its thousand ramifications, the concrete realizations that are increasingly mutilating us. We need to understand that the spreading of production and control that the new technologies allow makes sabotage easier. It would be impossible to attack them otherwise. The same goes for schools, barracks, and offices. Although they are inseparable from the whole of hierarchical and mercantile relations, they still concretize themselves in specific people and places. How, when we are so few, can we make ourselves visible to students, workers, and unemployed? If one thinks in terms of consensus and image, making oneself visible, to be precise, the reply can be taken for granted. Unions and cunning politicians are far stronger than we are. Once again, what is lacking is the capacity to put together and break apart again. Reformism acts on detail, quantitatively. It mobilizes vast numbers of people in order to change a few isolated aspects of power. A global critique of society, on the other hand, allows a qualitative vision of action to emerge. Precisely because there are no centers or revolutionary subjects to subordinate one's projects to, each aspect of social reality relates back to the whole of which it is a part. No matter whether it's a question of pollution, prison, or urban planning, any really subversive discourse ends up putting everything into question. Today, more than ever, a quantitative project of assembling students, workers, or unemployed in permanent organizations with a specific program can only act on detail, emptying actions of the strength of putting questions that cannot be reduced to a separation into categories, such as students, workers, immigrants, homosexuals, etc. All the more so as reformism is less and less capable of reforming anything. Think of unemployment and the way it is falsely presented as a resolvable breakdown in economic rationality. Someone said that even the request for non-toxic food has become a revolutionary project because any attempt to satisfy it would involve changing the whole of social relations. Any demand that is addressed to a precise interlocutor carries its own defeat within it. If for no other reason than that no authority could be capable of resolving a problem of generalist significance even if it wanted to. To whom does one turn to oppose air pollution? The workers who, during a wildcat strike, carried a banner saying, quote, "We are not asking for anything," understood that the defeat is in the claim itself. The claim against the enemy is eternal. There is no alternative but to take everything. As Stirner said, no matter how much you give them, they will always ask for more, because what they want is no less than the end of every concession. And then, even though you are few, you can think of acting without doing so in isolation, in the knowledge that in explosive situations, a few good contacts are more useful than large numbers. Sadly, it often happens that rights-claiming social struggles develop more interesting methods than they do objectives. For example, a group of unemployed asking for work ends up burning down the Dole office. Of course, one could remain aloof, saying that work should not be asked for, but destroyed. Or one could try to link a critique of the whole economy to that so passionately burned office, or a critique of the unions to an act of sabotage. Each individual objective in the struggle contains the violence of the whole of social relations ready to explode. The banality of their immediate cause, as we know, is the calling card of revolts throughout history. What can a group of resolute comrades do in such situations? Not much, unless they have already thought, for example, about how to give out a leaflet or at what points of the city to widen a protest, or what is more, if a gay or lawless intelligence makes them forget numbers and great organizational structures. Without wanting to revive the myth that the general strike is the unshackling of insurrection, it is clear enough that the interruption of all social activity is still decisive. Subversive action must tend towards the paralysis of normality, no matter what originally caused the clash. If students continue to study, workers, those who remain of them, and office employees to work, the unemployed to worry about unemployment, then no change will be possible. Revolutionary practice will always be above the people. Any organization that is separate from social struggles can neither unleash revolt or extend and defeat it. If it is true that the exploited tend to line up behind those who are able to guarantee economic improvements during the course of the struggle, if it is true, in other words, that any struggle to demand better conditions is necessarily of a reformist character, libertarians could push through the methods, individual autonomy, direct action, permanent conflictuality, that go beyond making demands to denying all social identities, teacher, clerk, worker, etc. An established libertarian organization making claims would merely flank the struggles. Only a few of the exploited would choose to belong to it, or would lose its libertarian characteristics. The trades unions are the best qualified in the field of syndicalist struggles. An organizational structure formed by revolutionaries and exploited is only really in conflict if it is in tune with the temporary nature of one specific struggle, has a clear aim, and is in the perspective of attack. In a word, if it is a critique in act of the union and its collaboration with the bosses, we cannot say that subversives have a great capacity to launch social struggles, anti-militarist and against environmental toxicity, for example, at this very moment. There remains, for all those who do not maintain that, quote, people are accomplice and resigned, the hypothesis of autonomous intervention in struggles, or in the fairly extensive acts of rebellion that arise spontaneously. If we are looking for a clear expression of the kind of society the exploited are fighting for, as one subtle theoretician claimed in the face of a recent wave of attacks, we might as well stay at home. If we simply limit ourselves, which is not very different to critical support, we are merely adding our red and black flags to those of the parties and unions. Once again, critique of detail espouses the quantitative model. If we think that when the unemployed talk about the right of work, we should be doing the same, making the obvious distinction between wages and, quote, socially useful activity, then the only place for action seems to be the streets full of demonstrators. As old Aristotle was aware, representation is only possible if there is unity of time and place. But who said it is not possible to talk to the unemployed of sabotage, the abolition of rights, or the refusal to pay rent whilst practicing at the same time? Who said that when workers come out into the streets on strike, the economy cannot be criticized elsewhere? To say what the enemy does not expect and to be where they are not waiting for us? That is the new poetry. Not only do we desire to change our lives immediately, it is the criterion by which we are seeking our accomplices. The same goes for what one might call a need for coherency. The will to live one's ideas and create theory starting from one's own life is not a search for the exemplary or the hierarchical paternalistic side of the same coin. It is a refusal of all ideology, including that of pleasure. We set ourselves apart from those who content themselves with areas that they manage to carve out and safeguard for themselves in this society, even before we begin to think, by the very way we palpate our existence. But we feel just as far removed from those who would like to desert daily normality and put their faith in the mythology of clandestiny and combat organizations locking themselves up in other cages. No role, no matter how much it puts one at risk in terms of the law, can take the place of the real changing of relations. There is no shortcut, no immediate leap into the elsewhere. The revolution is not a war. In the past, the inauspicious ideology of arms transformed the need for coherence of a few into the gregariousness of the many. May arms finally turn themselves against ideology. An individual with a passion for social upheaval and a personal vision of the class clash wants to do something immediately. If he or she analyzes the transformation of capital and the state, it is in order to attack them, certainly not as to be able to go to sleep with clearer ideas. If they have not interjected the prohibitions and distinctions of the prevailing law and morals, they draw up the rules of their own game, using every instrument possible, contrary to the writer. Or the soldier for whom these are professional affairs, so have a mercantile identity. The pen and the revolver are equally arms for them. The subversive remains subversive even without pen or gun, so long as they possess the weapon that contains all the others, their own resoluteness. Armed struggle is a strategy that could be put at the service of any project. The guerrilla is still used today by organizations whose programs are substantially social democratic. They simply support their demands with military practice. Politics can also be done with arms. In any negotiation with power, that is, any relationship that maintains the latter as interlocutor, be it even as adversary, the negotiators must present themselves as representative force. From this perspective, representing a social reality means reducing it to one's own organization. The armed clash must not spread spontaneously, but be linked to the various phases of negotiation. The organization will manage the results, relations amongst members of the organization and between the latter and the rest of the world reflect what an authoritarian program is. They take hierarchy and obedience very seriously. The problem is not all that different from those aiming for the violent conquest of political power. It is a question of propagandizing one's strength as a vanguard capable of directing the revolutionary movement. Armed struggle is presented as the superior form of social struggle. Whoever is more militarily representative, thanks to the spectacular successes of those actions, constitutes the authentic armed party. The staged trials and people's tribunals that result are acts of those who want to put themselves in place of the state. For its part, the state has every interest in reducing the revolutionary threat to a few combatant organizations in order to transform subversion into a clash between two armies. The institutions on one hand, and the armed party on the other. What power fears most is autonomous, generalized rebellion. The media image of the terrorist works hand in hand with the police in the defense of a social peace. No matter whether the citizen applauds or is scared, he is still a citizen, i.e., a spectator. The reformist embellishment of the existent feeds armed mythology, producing the false alternative between legal and clandestine politics. It suffices to note how many left Democrats are sincerely moved by the figure of the guerrilla in Mexico and Latin America. Passivity requires advisors and specialists. When it is disappointed by the traditional ones, it lines up behind the new. As an armed organization with a program and a monogram, specific to revolutionaries can certainly have libertarian characteristics, just as the social revolution desired by many anarchists is undoubtedly also an armed struggle. But is that enough? If we recognize the need to organize the armed deed during the insurrectional clash, if we support the possibility of attacking the structures and men of power from this minute on, and consider the horizontal linking of affinity groups in practices of revolt to be decisive, we are criticizing the perspective of those who see armed action as the transcendence of the limits of social struggles, attributing a superior role to one form of the struggle. Moreover, by the use of monograms and programs, we see the creation of an identity that separates revolutionaries from the rest of the exploited, making them visible to power and putting them in a condition that lends itself to representation. In this way, the armed attack is no longer just one of many instruments of one's liberation, but is charged with a symbolic value and tends to appropriate anonymous rebellion to its own ends. The informal organization as a fact, linked to the temporary aspects of struggles, becomes a permanent and formalized decision-making structure. In this way, what was an occasion for meeting in one's own projects becomes a veritable project in itself. The organization begins to desire to reproduce itself exactly like the quantitative reformist structures do. Inevitably, sad trousseau of communique and documents appear where one raises one's voice and finds oneself clashing an identity that exists only because it had been declared. Actions of attack that are quite similar to other, simply anonymous ones, come to represent who knows what qualitative leap in revolutionary practice. The schema of politics reappears as one starts flying in a straight line. Of course, the need to organize is something that can always accompany subversive practice beyond the temporary requirements of a struggle. But in order to organize oneself, there is a need for living, concrete agreements, not an image in search of spotlights. The secret of the subversive game is the capacity to smash deforming mirrors and find oneself face to face with one's own nakedness. Organization is the whole of the projects that make this game come alive. All of the rest is political prosthesis and nothing else. Insurrection is far more than armed struggle, because during it, the generalized clash is at one with the upsetting of the social order. The old world is upturned to the extent to which the insurgent exploited are all armed. Only then are the arms not the separate expression of some vanguard, the monopoly of the bosses and bureaucrats of the future, but the concrete condition of the revolutionary feast, the collective possibility of widening and defending the transformation of social relations. Subversive practice is even less armed struggle in the absence of the insurrectional rupture, unless one wants to restrict the immensity of one's passions to no more than a few instruments. It is a question of contenting oneself with pre-established roles or seeking coherency in the most remote point, life. Then, in the spreading revolt, we will really be able to perceive a marvelous conspiracy of egos aimed at creating a society without bosses or dormant. A society of free and unique individuals. Life cannot simply be something to cling to. This thought skims through everyone at least once. We have a possibility that makes us freer than the gods. We can quit. This is an idea to be savored to the end. Nothing and no one is obliging us to live, not even death. For that reason, our life is a tabula rasa, a slate on which nothing has been written, so contains all the words possible. With such freedom, we cannot live as slaves. Slavery is for those who are condemned to live, those constrained to eternity, not for us. For us, there is the unknown. The unknown of spheres to be ventured into, unexplored thoughts, guarantees that explode, strangers to whom to offer a gift of life. The unknown of a world where one might finally be able to give away one's excess self-love. Risk too. The risk of brutality and fear. The risk of finally staring mal de vivre in the face. All this is encountered by anyone who decides to put an end to the job of existing. Our contemporaries seem to live by jobbing, desperately juggling with a thousand obligations, including the saddest of them all, enjoying themselves. They cover up the incapacity to determine their own lives with detailed frenetic activity, the speed that accompanies increasingly passive ways of behaving. They are unaware of the lightness of the negative. We can choose not to live. That is the most beautiful reason for opening oneself up to life with joy. There is always time to put an end to things. One might as well rebel and play, is how the materialism of joy talks. We can choose not to act, and that is the most beautiful reason for acting. We bear within ourselves the potency of all acts we are capable of, and no boss will ever be able to deprive us of the possibility of saying no. What we are and what we want begins from a no. From it is born the only reason for getting up in the morning. From it is born the only reason for going armed to the assault of an order that is suffocating us. On the one hand, there is the existent, with its habits and certainties. And of certainty, that social poison? One can die. On the other hand, there is insurrection, the unknown bursting into the life of all, the possible beginning of an exaggerated practice of freedom. Never surrender. Just listening to the Union of Time Thieves on KBOO Portland. Coming up next, Sudden Radio.
This is Saddam Hussein.
And this is Osama bin Laden.
We have come together on this solemn occasion to pay our respects to the dearly departed American president, the great Ronald Reagan, a man to whom each of us owes a great deal of gratitude, and to thank him for his support and encouragement that we received from his administration. It is a tribute to his greatness that Osama bin Laden, the fanatical Wahhabist nutcase,
and Saddam Hussein, the infidel coddling false Islamist dog, could put aside our differences and join together in tribute to a man affectionately known as the Gibber.
In 1980, the great people of Iraq went to war with that conniving obscenity of a nation, Iran. The United States prevented the United Nations from even discussing the matter for many days.
But a few years later, Saddam was on the verge of a humiliating defeat.
Shut up, Herr Farmer.